Dr. Richard Feynman, theoretical physicist at Caltech and Nobel laureate, once wrote, "I stand at the seashore, alone, and start to think. There are the rushing waves, mountains of molecules, each stupidly minding its own business, trillions apart, yet forming white surf in unison. Ages on ages, before any eyes could see, year after year, thunderously pounding the shore as now. For whom? For what? On a dead planet, with no life to entertain, never at rest, tortured by energy, wasted prodigiously by the sun, poured into space. A mite makes the sea roar. Deep in the sea, all molecules repeat the patterns of one another until complex new ones are formed. They make others like themselves, and a new dance starts, growing in size and complexity. Living things, masses of atoms, DNA, protein, dancing a pattern ever more intricate. Out of the cradle, onto the dry land. And here, it is standing. Atoms with consciousness, matter with curiosity, stands at the sea, wonders at wondering. I, a universe of atoms, an atom in the universe. So, what is this mind? What are these atoms with consciousness? Last week's potatoes. That is what now can remember what was going on in my mind a year ago. A mind which has long ago been replaced. This is what it means when one discovers how long it takes for the atoms of the brain to be replaced by other atoms, to note that the thing which I call my individuality is only a pattern or dance. The atoms come into my brain, dance a dance, and then go out. Always new atoms, but always doing the same dance, remembering the dance that was yesterday. End of Richard Feynman's quotation. Atoms with consciousness, matter with curiosity, a universe becoming conscious of itself. Is this your perception of reality? Perhaps we should first ask, what is reality? I don't know how you feel about it, but I approach this question with some degree of trepidation, or at least disquietude. Not that I expect to uncover any startling revelations which will forever change my relationship to the universe. Still, I tread lightly, scraping away the barnacles of accumulated belief systems that justify our hopes and calm our fears may be irritating, if not downright painful. Kurt Goldstein, psychiatrist, speaks of a catastrophic anxiety, the most severe form of anxiety, wherein you feel your ego structure threatened by attacks upon your perception of reality. Reality sanctioned by your culture or religion. And then, too, I am also reminded of the admonition of my fifth grade Irish nun teacher, who said, "Don't ask so many questions. You may find the answers." I shall never forget the dream I had that night. Unexpectedly, I found myself slowly walking down the nave of a deserted cathedral, crowded with menacing, holy shadows. Despite my fear, I felt compelled to climb those altar steps, stand before the tabernacle, and draw aside the veils. It was empty. Nothing, absolutely nothing, in the Holy of Holies, and I woke up screaming. My first encounter with the mystics' no-thingness, nothingness, which naturally I did not understand. Next Saturday, at the confessional, I dutifully reported my dream and my doubts to old Father Sullivan, who nearly had a heart attack. He piled enough penance to keep me in church for the next month, making me an instant hero among my schoolmates. Surely, I must have committed a glorious offense to deserve such a grand penance. In a similar vein, Voltaire, in his novel Micromegas, tells of a wise and ancient alien visiting the Earth, of E.T. in a 18th century setting. As a parting gift, the extraterrestrial leaves the book which summarizes all knowledge about the ultimate nature of reality. When the philosophers open the book, they discover only blank pages. At this juncture, I suppose I could turn off the tape recorder and leave you with a lovely blank cassette. Retreat in mute eloquence. Very Taoistic. Fortunately, or unfortunately, I am still intimidated by conventional expectations. I will therefore turn instead to the dictionary, the Sancho Panza of my quixotic search, and in so doing, immediately stumble into a cranberry bog of confusion. The first definition of reality, to be found in the American Heritage Dictionary, reads, "The quality or state of being, actual or true." Well, that's no definition at all, merely a substitution of terms. What do they mean by actual or true? A rolling stone may gather no moss, but a readily used word gathers connotations, and often contradictory. The word actual generally denotes that which can be demonstrated, or that which acts, or has an effect. Many of science's most cherished hypotheses arise out of this pragmatic approach to reality. The space-time continuum, the expanding universe, quarks, black holes, even consciousness itself, cannot be directly observed, only deduced from their apparent effects. On the other hand, the word true implies a belief which will conform to facts. If it's true, it's a fact. Facts are real. Not necessarily. Despite schoolbook maxims, facts may not constitute reality. A theorem of mathematics may be true, but have no bearing on reality. You can lie about a real event. Truth, as we speak of it here, is a logical term, a quality or property of statements, which may or may not refer to reality. Coming back to the Heritage Dictionary, the final definition declares reality to be the totality of all things, possessing actuality, existence, or essence. Did you ever think reality so complicated? At least here, we begin to discern the boundaries and constraints of our Western perception of reality. The totality of all things. Things. Things as distinct from what? Primarily thoughts, with their projected distortions. Imagery, dreams, hallucinations, and delusions. Confluent configurations of the mind. Real things, stones, stars, flowers, shoes, reside in space and time. They possess a separate existence, an objective existence out there, beyond our seductive mindscapes. The everyday reality of common sense, which literally means those things conveyed through any of our common senses. Touching, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting. Or as Ma Bell's commercials so lovingly croon, a reach out and touch someone reality. Nietzsche named this belief the fallacy of the immaculate perception. How did we become embedded in such a concrete reality? By inheritance, our Roman cultural inheritance. If you go to the root of the matter, you discover our word reality comes from the Latin res, R-E-S, meaning thing. The Romans were ever a practical people. They constructed durable roads, maintained aqueducts, systematized legal codes, and trained efficient armies. They created no new art, formulated no original systems of philosophy, and made no scientific discoveries. Later, we will explore the current limitations of such rigorously confined reality. But for now, just one question. How real can a thing be if its parts are not real? How real is the red rose. If the protons, neutrons, and electrons that compose it are not perceptible to the very senses that identify the red rose as real, let us return once again to the dictionary definition. Reality is the totality of all things possessing actuality, existence, or essence. We touched lightly on thingness and actuality. What about existence and essence? The word existence possesses a chameleon quality, changing its connotations to fit the semantic occasion. At times it can be sternly Roman in spirit, designating itself the state of anything with a nature or a substance of its own, functioning in space and time. Thingness, italicized. Then again, the word seems to be transformed into an ontological will-o'-the-wisp, implying a stoic sense of being endured through whatever vicissitudes. But the word essence, that is another whole kettle of metaphysical fish. Philosophically, essence denotes the inherent, unchanging nature of things, beingness. Quite the opposite of thingness. And thus we encounter the second historical and contradictory component of our Western reality concept, beingness. Our Greek inheritance. Maybe the dramatic juxtaposition of mountains and sea, brilliantly highlighted by the Aegean sun, made the early Greeks distrustful of sensory impressions. And then again, as sailors, they may have learned how deceitful appearances can be. The sudden squall that turns a gentle sea into a raging maelstrom. Whatever the reason, many sought an ultimate reality that extended beyond the immediate sensory experience, beyond the kaleidoscopic facade of nature. They yearn for the permanence of a eternal, unchanging unity of being. A major advocate for the principle of beingness was Parmenides, a Greek philosopher living in the first half of the 5th century BC. Many scholars say he invented logic for what essentially was an illogical premise. You can judge for yourself. Believing all the senses deceptive, he asserted that the multitude of things perceived through the senses consists of illusions. The only reality is the one, the undifferentiated unity. Seemingly a mystical doctrine, but unconventionally so. As conceived by Parmenides, the one, or being, consists of an unchanging, static substance, spherical in shape, and indivisible, because the whole of it is present everywhere. Now, somewhat akin to the modern idea of a holographic universe. But if being or oneness extends spatially and nothing else exists, there can be no empty space. Therefore, motion and change, generation and destruction are impossible. Illusions perpetuated by our conjuring senses. What a terrible burden to place upon our poor senses. Parmenides, among others, did influence Plato, 427 to 347 BC. Possibly the most illustrious philosopher of the Western world. Although a good case might be made for Aristotle as a co-equal. Nevertheless, for the next 1,000 years, Plato had a dominant influence upon Western thinking. Early Christianity, for example, may have been Judaic in its origins, but it became Roman in its administration and Platonic in its theology. As with Parmenides, Plato begins with the conviction that a distinction exists between the real and the phenomenal. In this case, phenomenal refers to those things perceived through the senses. What we have just described as Roman reality or thingness. Plato further amplifies this distinction through his theory of forms or ideas, expressed in his great dialogues, Phaedo, and then the Republic. His argument goes something like this. When I speak to you of a rose, you immediately know what I'm talking about. Rose is a general word. And yet you may never see the red rose I carry in my hand. As a matter of fact, you may be visualizing the yellow rose that grows outside your window. But your yellow rose and my red rose share in a general nature common to all roses, a universal rosiness. This rosiness was not created when your yellow rose bloomed, nor will it disappear when my red rose dies. Whatever the size, shape, color, genetic improvement of any single rose, rosiness itself remains timeless. Or in the immortal words of Gertrude Stein, a rose is a rose is a rose. Now, all this may appear perfectly logical to you, but Plato adds a metaphysical flourish. The general word rose implies an immutable, archetypical rose, the perfect rose, the ideal rose created by God. My red rose and your yellow rose partake of the nature of the rose, and yet they present, more or less, imperfect reflections of it. No matter how glorious the rose we see, touch, and smell in the garden, they will all eventually fade, die, and disintegrate because they are imperfect copies of the eternal idea or form of rose. As with roses, so with all things of the physical world. Flickering shadows on cave walls. Plato's reality exists solely within those eternal ideas or forms, and can only be known through the intellect or imagination. A far cry from thingness. Plato's dualism of reality and appearance, ideas and objects, reason and sense perception, soul and body, has left an indelible hallmark on Western thought, religion, and mysticism. Shall we linger a moment in the shade of a bower of roses and look back over the path we have traveled in our quest for reality? Three major elements constitute our traditional Western consensus of the real: actuality, the pragmatic approach, if it works, it is real; thingness, if you can perceive it through the senses, touch it, taste it, see it, smell it, hear it, then it is objectively real; and finally, beingness, only if it exists in the realm of eternity can it be real. During the 2,500 years of European civilization, we have fashioned our perspective of reality into an idol, an unholy trinity, wherein these three elements blend into one Godhead. Rather indiscriminately, we worship first one aspect and then another of our ragtag scarecrow god. In ancient Greece, they focused primarily on beingness. The Romans hailed thingness. The Middle Ages retreated to beingness. And finally, the scientific revolution concentrated again on thingness, laced with actuality. Periodically, we change our high priest in charge of the sanctuary, our diviners, our arbitrators of reality. Philosophers give away to theologians, theologians yield to scientists, but the idol remains unchanged. Precious few dare lift their heads to challenge the keepers of the flame. Are there other realities? Alternate realities? Surely you do not believe Europeans had exclusive dibs on reality. There exists a Hindu-Buddhist reality, the Chinese reality of Confucian and Taoist traditions, the shamanistic reality, the hunting and gathering reality, the Islamic reality, the Olmec, Mayan, Aztec reality, to name but a few. Only in this context, we must expand our ethnocentric dictionary definitions and propose reality to be a way of organizing and thereby comprehending experience. That may be, but certainly our scientific reality is more real. Well, at least more verifiable. What scientific reality are you talking about? The Newtonian universe, based upon classical physics? That paradigm is as dead as the dodo bird, as passé, antiquated as the classical Greek or Aristotelian scientific reality, or the Islamic or the medieval Chinese scientific reality. If you still believe the myth, the scientists have finally corralled, hogtied, and branded ultimate reality, then get off your worshiping knees and take a good, hard look. Not only did our idolatrized Western reality, wearing the guise of classical scientific realism, restrict our vision, making less real and thereby less important such domains as consciousness, art, social sciences, and ethics, that eventually it even failed to delineate physical reality in all its dimensions. The Newtonian universe had been reduced to inert matter and blind energy, oblivious to any life within it. Such was the forlorn vision of the cosmos at the end of the 19th century. And yet, from a practical standpoint, Newtonian physics, mechanics, achieved an astounding success as the fundamental theory of all observable events. It literally transformed our world. Astronomy, biology, chemistry, medicine, philosophy, psychology were reshaped, redefined by Newton's worldview. Indeed, our entire industrial civilization has been built upon the bedrock of this classical scientific reality. Then what happened? Why did Newton's model of the universe suddenly collapse in the 20th century? And how did this failure shatter our 2,500-year-old idol? Not all the king scientists, nor all the king's theologians, could put this Humpty Dumpty reality of thingness and beingness back together again. And yet, we hear no weeping throughout the land. But who mourns these days for shattered idols or dead gods? We may find some of the answers by going back to the beginning of the scientific revolution, when we were just emerging from the medieval paradigm of beingness.